Studio 360.
Before there was this.
This looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Or this.
Say it again, Sam. Say the alphabet.
A, B, C, D.
Or this.
If that plane leaves the ground and you're not on it with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
It's beautiful.
It's from Casablanca. I waited my whole life to say it.
There was this.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss.
Casablanca was released 75 years ago this year. And it's such an iconic film that we forget how urgent and timely it was when it first came out. Casablanca came out during the first full year of the Americans fighting in World War II, 1942, and the year that the Allies invaded North Africa, which the Nazis occupied, including Casablanca, the city in Morocco. My guests today are the film scholar Noah Eisenberg, who's got a new book called We'll Always Have Casablanca, and Karina Longworth, host of the terrific podcast You Must Remember This, which is a very juicy and very intelligent examination of old Hollywood. Noah and Karina, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Karina, I listened to your podcast episode on Humphrey Bogart. First of all, I had forgotten that he's a preppy New Yorker, which is so out of sync with what one thinks of Humphrey Bogart being. But he was very much a late bloomer, right?
Yeah. I mean, he didn't really become a movie star until his late 30s, early 40s. And it took him a while to develop a persona in Hollywood. I mean, there were a couple of key films. He played a gangster in The Petrified Forest in 1936.
First time any one of you makes a wrong move, I'm going to kill a whole lot of you.
That was sort of him, you know, stepping his toe in the water of this thing that he'd become known for, which was an anti-hero, somebody who's technically doing bad things but is so charismatic that the audience loves him.
Right.
And then he really took that to a new level in 1940 with the film High Sierra, where he plays another, you know, no good guy, but you sort of root for him to win, you know, the heart of the lady in that movie.
Right. Noah, was that a new thing? I mean, now, you know, we have a golden age of television devoted to that kind of anti-hero person. But in 1940, 1942, was this the bad guy who you like anyway? Was that a kind of new figure in cinema?
I don't know whether it was necessarily new, but Humphrey Bogart definitely brought it to a new place.
Yeah.
And by the time he gets to Casablanca, he really makes this extraordinary transformation, something about which, and Karina, you talk about it in your podcast as well, about being kind of unsettled by, I think, this transformation, not really feeling totally comfortable with suddenly being thought of as a, you know, romantic lead. And he didn't know whether he could pull this off.
Just one thing I want to add about the sort of transformation of his persona. You know, in between High Sierra and Casablanca, you do have The Maltese Falcon, which is Bogart's first movie with John Huston. And you see him kind of becoming this John Huston man in that movie. You know, he's hard drinking and he's hedonistic and he knows how to use a gun and he might even like using a gun. But he also has this code of ethics that he lives by.
Right.
But women aren't necessarily central to the Huston man.
Right.
And then with Casablanca, you see him bringing all of those qualities into this space where he's a man who, you know, has this romantic past and the romantic past, like, comes back into the present.
Right. What about Ilsa, Ingrid Bergman, of course, who is Rick's ex-lover and with whom he'll always have Paris. This was not quite introducing her, but she was brand new to America, right?
Yeah. So she had been brought over from Sweden by David O. Selznick, who was a producer and a studio mogul. But when he saw her in person for the first time, he was disappointed. She wasn't as glamorous as he wanted her to be, and so he told her he was going to give her the full makeover, and she refused. She said, either take what I am or leave it.
Huh.
And so then he came up with this idea of, like, okay, so this one, we're going to sell her as a natural. She's a natural beauty. And, you know, I mean, when we see her now in a film like Casablanca, she seems so ethereal and exotic compared to maybe what we're used to. But in the context of Hollywood in 1942, she was, you know, relatively pared back in terms of glamour.
And, that's interesting.
And there was this idea that, like, she was authentic and natural.
Meaning not Veronica Lake or something.
Yeah, not so heavily made up and not
–
she hadn't been
eyebrows,
molded
right?
by Hollywood.
Right. And so Bogart and Bergman were not Warner Brothers' first choices for these, for Ilsa and Rick?
Well, I mean, there was plenty of studio generated gossip. You have that you know, that planted piece about Reagan and Ann Sheridan,
yes,
co-starring.
I want that alternative universe where Ronald Reagan is Rick Blaine.
Right? Can you imagine what would have happened?
The chemistry or lack of chemistry between Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart. What was the story there?
Well, I mean, that's one of the sort of magical things about this movie, that it works out so that it becomes one of the great romantic films of all time, because they didn't like each other and they had a really hard time playing the romance. I mean, we spoke earlier about how Bogart was not somebody who played romances before this film. He was also in a very messy, violent marriage at the time. This was before he met Lauren Bacall. So he was unhappy in his personal life. And, you know, Bergman was very frustrated by the different changes in the script. You know, the movie was being rewritten and rewritten as they were making it. And, you know, they were trying to play these romantic scenes and not knowing who she'd end up with in the end.
Huh. One of the people in this great big cast I'm interested in is the piano player, Sam, played by Arthur Dooley Wilson. And Noah, reading your book, I was surprised to find he wasn't actually playing the piano in the film, although he was singing. Here he is with Bogart.
Boss, let's get out of here.
No, sir. I'm waiting for a lady.
Please, boss, let's go. Ain't nothing but trouble for you here.
Coming back? I know she's coming back.
We'll take the car and drive all night. We'll get drunk. We'll go fishing and stay away until she's gone.
Shut up and go home, will you?
No, sir. I'm staying right here.
Now, Sam and Rick obviously have this very close buddy relationship, and I was trying to think if I could think of any other comparable relationship between a black man and a white man in the movies at the time. Were there?
I don't know of any single performance by an African-American actor of the 1940s that is as fully developed as was Dooley Wilson playing Sam in Casablanca. And I read the review of the film in the Amsterdam News, and one of the only, you know, black-owned newspapers in New York City, where the critic really extols the advances made by Dooley Wilson in his portrayal of Sam. You know, he's not another Pullman porter. He's not a cook. He's not a valet.
And nor is it comedy.
Right. Exactly.
It's a dramatic role.
Exactly. He never was able to land another role that would give him that kind of depth and that kind of complexity.
On the poster for Casablanca, Bogart and Bergman are there, of course. But this was an amazing ensemble cast. And what I had never thought about or realized is how many of these people had fled the Nazis.
You despise me, don't you?
Well, if I gave you any thought, I probably would.
But why? Oh, you object to the kind of business I do, huh? But think of all those poor refugees who must rot in this place if I didn't help them. Well, that's not so bad. Through ways of my own, I provide them with exit visas.
For a price, Ugarte. For a price.
That was, of course, Peter Lorre playing the skeevy Ugarte. Noah, talk about him. Talk about Peter Lorre and how he got to the United States and what was going on with him.
Yeah, Peter Lorre had fled the Nazi regime. He'd made his breakout performance as the child murderer in Fritz Lang's M from 1931.
And he was a Jew.
Yes, he had been born in the provinces of Hungary, given the name Laszlo Löwenstein, and he changed that name,
goodness,
as we all know exactly. he made his way then to Hollywood. He shacked up with a young and similarly destitute Billy Wilder. At any rate, he ended up playing a lot of quirky characters. He'd already been marked. He was always sort of ethnically dubious. Think of Joel Cairo in The Maltese Falcon and all of his passports and his accent too.
Then there's Victor Laszlo, I don't want to say poor chump, but Victor Laszlo, the head of the Czech resistance, who is Ingrid Bergman's, Ilsa's husband, played by Paul Henride.
Don't you sometimes wonder if it's worth all this? I mean, what you're fighting for.
We might as well question why we breathe. If we stop breathing, we'll die. If we stop fighting our enemies, the world will die.
Now what of it? It'll be out of its misery.
You know how you sound, Mr. Blaine? like a man who's trying to convince himself of something he doesn't believe in his heart.
Now, again, I didn't know, Paul Henreid, another anti-Nazi activist German, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. He was actually born in Trieste when it was still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But he was an activist, and Carina did a wonderful series on You Must Remember This on these blacklisted actors and the different forms of resistance.
The American blacklist in the 1950s.
Exactly. But Henreid was one of the people who marched in Washington, was very, very outspoken, was very committed. That sort of principled resistance that you see in his portrayal of Victor Laszlo, I think he carried that with him off screen as well. And he brought that kind of principled commitment. That's not what I think audiences at the time were necessarily looking for.
Here we are, a year into the war, or the United States being in the war. And like, what's always interested me in that historical context about this film is he is the hero. Victor Laszlo is the hero. And we were all supposed to be heroes then. And that was certainly the American propaganda idea. And yet he's the minor character. And this guy who, you know, doesn't really care and isn't really engaged is the hero. I find that so interesting in the middle of the Great War. Mm.
Mm. Well, I think that what's happening there is that, you know, the movie is dramatizing, you know, what is going to happen to a lot of American men and regular Americans,
right,
who, you know, certainly up until that point didn't think that the war in Europe was their problem. But what Casablanca shows is that it's everybody's problem.
Right.
You know, I mean, everybody is going to have to sacrifice something. And,
exactly.
You know, even if you don't consider yourself that kind of guy, the war makes us all that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And the other stuff doesn't amount to a hill of beans, is how I'd put it.
Very original.
And there, again, we could just go on about this cast, that these lives that these people had just led, which could – all of whom could have been characters in the film Casablanca.
Exactly. That's precisely what I think really gives the film its texture. I think without all of those people who really experienced it firsthand, it just wouldn't have that kind of pattern of authenticity, which an otherwise Hollywood-confected studio picture, you know, couldn't possibly have. It wouldn't be possible.
So we have all these refugees, many or most of them Jewish, playing refugees essentially. The script does not mention Jews, right? Concentration camp is mentioned, but
correct,
not – and, you know, the extermination of the Jews had begun, as this film was being made, essentially. Was dealing with the Jewish question or not a question that the screenwriters in the studio wrestled with?
I don't think it ever even came up that they would be able to address it head on. This was 1942, after all.
Yeah.
Almost no movies were talking about this.
But Jack and Harry Warner, who run Warner Brothers, are Jewish and anti-fascist activists before that was really the consensus.
No, they were absolutely on the vanguard of Hollywood in terms of responding to the Nazis. I mean, they pulled out of Germany in, I think, 1934, way before any other studio did. All of the other studios continued to do business with Germany because they didn't want to give up that profit source, but the Warners just wouldn't do it.
So it's one thing in 34, and that's brave and amazing and putting your money where your mouth is. But so then 39, the war starts. What about that 2 years between the war starting but us not in it? Were studios still like distributing pictures into Nazi Germany?
It was definitely something that a lot of the studios held on. I mean, even studios, you know, run by Jews like MGM. Louis B. Mayer was a European Jew, but it was just so difficult to cut off that source of funds.
And
you know, a lot of these studios also were, you know, kind of massaging the content of their movies so that they would continue to play well in Europe and in places where, you know, the hard line against fascism was not so hard.
So it's like it's like the way Google and Apple sort of modify things for China today, right?
And there's an interesting kind of corollary to that too, in terms of the immediate post-war period when it took time for Casablanca to be shown in the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, and it was heavily edited. All references to Nazis were removed from the film. Yeah, and Victor Laszlo then was no longer
the movie lasted 12 minutes.
Yeah,
right.
<No. laughs> I discovered this film in the 1970s, and of course, because 19-year-olds think everything is about them, and you figure, we must have just all rediscovered this. But was between the 40s and the late 60s, early 70s, was this a cinematic cult thing?
I mean, one thing I've actually been meaning to mention is the discovery of this film and other films that did not make it to France during the war by the French film critics of the 50s, who then a lot of them became the French New Wave filmmakers, you know? So you have, like, Truffaut and Godard and Chabrol. And, you know, obviously, like, Bogart in Casablanca and in other films became this sort of key icon that's brought into Godard's Breathless. And, you know, it's the writing about these movies that were just getting to Paris in, you know, or the early 1950s, mid-1950s, that end up influencing this next revolution of cinema.
I wonder how it will resonate these days. We, as international refugees, are more of an issue for the world than they have been since the 1940s. As people who don't like Donald Trump often think of themselves and hashtag themselves as resistance, are people going to look at this in a way they wouldn't have 10 or 20 or 30 years ago?
I think that in the current political climate, Casablanca has even more to say and has even, you know, a stronger resonance than perhaps it would have had things gone differently in our last election here. But also in light of the refugee crisis, I think it does continue to resonate in terms of the need to stick our necks out and to look after those who are in peril, fleeing oppression and persecution. And again, on a scale that is really at this point pretty much analogous to that of the Second World War.
Carina Longworth and Noah Eisenberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful being here.
We'll always have Casablanca. We'll be available in bookstores on February 14th, and I'm sure available for pre-order right now. And a new season of You Must Remember This has just started.